Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our monthly guidebook slash workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass, so if you want to learn more, go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header, and you'll be good to go. All right, everyone, we are here today with Alan Pasqua, who's a really amazing pianist. You may know him and as a keyboardist, pianist, composer, great teacher, and we're super psyched to have him here today. And before we get started, I just have the most important question I have is, you were raised in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey. Right. Roosevelt Park, New Jersey.
Right, same with me.
But he's a Red
me.
Sox fan.
Right, no, that's my point. How did a nice Jersey boy turn into a Red Sox fan?
You probably can't see, but back like at the bottom of my quilt are 2 seats from Fenway Park.
We're still going to do the podcast, but you know.
So, I mean,
how did that happen?
Mets or Yankees, right?
Yeah. I mean, how did it happen? Was it just because you went to New England Conservatory?
Yeah. I'm a baseball fan. And I mean, there were years where I was a, you know, hardcore Yankee fan. I mean, I took my dad to the 98 World Series, which was awesome.
That was a good year, man.
Yeah. You bet. It was a great team, too. Going to Fenway, as a student, and you know, seeing a doubleheader with like Oil Can Boyd, it's and Tiant, you know, it's just kind of
so you're like a Yastrzemski fan and shit like that too.
I've got some cool.
Who doesn't love Yaz?
I mean, he was the
good
man.
Memorabilia.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, this year was such an insane ride, but you know, at least if you're a Red Sox fan. You got to see them win. You got to see them win in this in that run, and you got to see them, you know, propel to excellence for a bit, and now everyone's kind of messed up. So we'll see what happens if there's fans or if there's.
I hope so. It's.
It was weird.
It's awful. But we got through it, you know.
Yeah, man. You know, at least there was something to take my mind off the dreck. You know.
Yes. So, yeah, exactly. For sure. I didn't think it would be possible, but it actually worked.
It did.
It's true.
It was just like a short Valium to take your mind off of things. And then, you know, before the reality sets in.
No refills.
Yeah. No, exactly.
One and done.
But what have you been up to recently during this whole COVID-ism insanity and... you know, everything else that's going on in the world, like how have you been holding up? I mean, I know that you have a family and I know that you teach a lot. Like, what are you doing to keep sane and keep busy?
Well, you know, the Pete Erskine and I and Darkles got off a plane at LAX on March 10th.
Oh, man.
And we were in Idaho with George Garzon playing, promoting our new record, Three Nights in L.A.
You got to love Garzon, man.
I can't imagine him in Idaho. Just him in Idaho should be its own sitcom.
He's my brother from another mother. Yeah, you know? That's George.
He's the man.
It was the most out weekend. I was gone for literally 4 days. I was in 2 hotspots. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then Boise, Idaho. And then we all flew back to LA, and then that LA was shut down.
That like was your last later. Hurrah. Yeah. What was your last hurrah?
Yeah. Oh my so, God. You know, I mean, the semester at SC, that was the end of spring semester. My daughter was a senior at USC, so that she was due to graduate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was in the pop program. They had big concerts scheduled and all that stuff. Everything just went away.
Yeah, it shut the bed.
It just, the whole thing just got blown to smithereens.
Yeah.
So, you know, the word virtual took on a whole new meaning.
Is she allowed to drop your name in school, or do you tell her not to?
She...
I'd be doing that all day.
She's funny. She kind of wants to go her own, you know, carve her own path, which I love. So. But, you know, it's all good. Every now and then, like Paul Jackson will come by her and I'll be standing there talking to her and he'll go, "Do you know who your father is?"
Right.
I'll go, yeah, he's her father.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And Paul Jackson, you know, he's another one. He's a monster.
PJ's so amazing. Yeah, man. So, you know, working at SC, which has been great. So I basically got home and then just started tweaking my little room here with my piano in it to provide, you know, it was twofold for me. One, I wanted to give my students as best an experience as I could, but I also needed, something to sound good and to look good and to, you know, so we could communicate. So,
I mean, to actually just looking at you now, I know the audience can't see it, but your room's impeccably lit. You know, that's very odd for, I mean, studios aren't usually that well lit. You have like really good lighting in there right now. Well, you do have a video light or something over there.
I just have, when I'm sitting at the piano, I just have a little, you know, nice. Small.
I remember right when this kicked off, we were emailing.
Yeah,
and you couldn't get a camera. All the webcams were just gone.
they were gone. I mean, I think the first time we did something, Jake, I was asking, or I had a GoPro. I bought a GoPro, but it didn't work.
Not live stream. You can't live stream it.
It didn't work. Right. So I mean, on one hand, it's been great because it's been a great learning curve for me of some stuff that I probably never would have ever had to. You know, experience, you know, the hardest part obviously has been the inability to communicate in real time with other musicians. That's been the absolute bone crusher. But
it's
a
weird, like, new frustration too. It's a feeling I've never, like, just teaching and you can't be there to just be like,
It's like, it's time for the next solo piano record, you know, but at the same time, you're going to miss, you know, there's too much of, and especially because you and Erskine and Darek, you play together all the time. You're at the same school. Yeah. Like, you're surrounded constantly by these, you know, inspirational, cool people that you perform with. So that's, to take that away, it's tough. And it's tough for everyone.
It is hard on everybody. My classes, you know, I taught private lessons and then I teach the upper level jazz improvisation course called Elements 2. And I had this year, I had 12 students. And that's all working in real time with everybody. We would basically learn four or five tunes. We'd learn them in different keys. There's no music in the classroom. Everything's from, you know, memory. We'd work on pretty high concept stuff, composition, all that just got blown to smithereens. So I had to really think on my feet to put some sort of a curriculum together that was meaningful, that I, you know, that I could kind of gear up for. Because I used to love, you know, I love going to that class because I got to play, I got to listen, critique, and all that just kind of went away. But, you know, we got through it. And then creatively for me, I had been in the beginnings of making a new solo recording. So I completed that and just released it this month, actually. It's called Daydream.
Nice.
I recorded some of it here. And I'm actually in new digs from where I was. But my piano, my Homburg Steinway, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, you didn't leave that at the old house, I guess.
I did not.
You guys take it. I don't feel like moving this thing.
Yeah. please don't place drinks on the piano.
Yeah,
a little sign there. Yeah, no, so it's that's been good. Chuck Scher from The Real Book contacted me, and he was putting out a series of composers and wanted to have me do one of the books.
Nice.
So, which was really awesome. So
all on your stuff?
Yeah, 20 of my compositions.
Oh, shit, man.
That's great. It's really cool lineup of people. Carla Bley, Kenny Werner. I'm trying to think who. Horace, I think Horace Silver. Yeah, it's complete honor. And so I spent a lot of time just figuring out the 20 tunes that I, over the course of many years, you know, a 20 year span, some were charts handwritten by me. I gave them all. To Greta, my daughter, I just said, I need your help to kind of engrave these.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it to look really good, you know.
So you did it by hand? You didn't do it on Sibelius or anything?
She did it all on Sibelius, but, you know, we made templates for title font, you know, chords, you know, certain size point. Because how often do you get one of those books and everything looks different? And it's, you know.
Right.
Page 7 is a bar napkin, you know.
No, exactly. Pretty much.
Yeah. So she nailed that. She did a great job with that. And that just came out.
That's awesome, man.
See, that's the shit. That she should get college credit for that, literally, but you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, she got credit on the book.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. That's like a real skill, you know. I mean,
doing total skill. Yeah. And her attention to detail is really fine. So it came up great.
Plus that there's work in that if you can do that along with being a musician in the early stages of your career. It's just like being a computer tech, you know. I mean, you know how to chart or how to arrange, obviously. I mean, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But man, that sounds great. So moving on to the beginning of your career, you were at New England. And I'm assuming that was like in the early 70s.
Yeah. I always keep this handy.
Oh man, look at
Let's
that.
Let's see if I can get the reflection.
Is that Miles?
No, it's Jackie Byard.
I can't even see. Oh, it's Jackie Byard.
Can you see it now?
Kind of.
Yeah, I see it back there. You got a rock star shirt on back there, I feel like.
And I'm the idiot all the way in the back behind Jackie was like.
Yeah, but you look super cool. You got Pink Floyd hair.
With a set of vibes in front of me. I don't know what the hell they're doing there.
Yeah, but.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, a set of vibraphones, yeah.
Oh, shit. I thought, and, damn, I didn't even know
that. Ricky Ford was playing tenor, and Gunther Schuller's kid, Ed, was playing bass in the band. And,
that sounds cool.
It was so great, yeah. That was my launching pad was Boston.
So was your first big break with Tony Williams in Lifetime, or were you – because I know that – from what I understand, you were playing Carnegie Hall when you met, or how did that happen?
Yeah, I had a couple of really great gigs in Boston while I was still a student,
like 18, or like 21, or something like that.
Yeah, I played in this band with this one of the great trumpet players. His name was Stanton Davis. He lives in New York, and we had a band called Ghetto Mysticism. Mm-hmm. Vinnie Johnson was the drummer from Lester Bowie's band. Bill Pierce played tenor.
There you go.
Leonard Brown played tenor. Jerome Harris played bass.
Yeah.
It was an amazing band.
Yeah.
Les Lumley played congas. I had played electric piano. I was the guy with the van. So
nice.
Well, it's because you had a Rhodes, right, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I was saying, if you have the suitcase, it was heavy as hell, man.
Yeah. It was great, though. So I did that. I had a 10-night run with Joe Williams at the Playboy Club, which was just mind-altering.
Yeah.
And I had one great gig with Frank Foster in Cambridge at a theater where he totally just took me to task.
Right.
And it was fantastic. It's a student a story I tell all my students, and he, in the middle of the gig, he turned around and he goes, "Alan, man, you sound beautiful, man." I'm like, "Yeah, thanks, Frank." "You know Body and Soul?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." He goes, "Great. Key of D." Boom.
Right.
And I just was like, "What?"
Yeah.
And I played every wrong possible, you know, change. And then he turned around, and in the middle of while I'm just crapping all over myself, he winks at me while he's playing.
He's like, listen, kid.
At the end of it, turned around and goes, man, that was beautiful. So, you know,
he tells you the different levels of yes and no.
Wow. Yeah.
That's like the lesson, you know. It's like
that is
when we talked to a George Coleman we had on. We did a masterclass with George Coleman, and he's talked about crossing, you know, like I think I might have told you that, but he's like, you had to cross the piano, would be so out of tune at these clubs that it wasn't like tuning. You know, you just change a minor third, you know, like, and that's why he can play things in all the keys, because you just had to.
Floating harmony.
Jackie Barrett. You know,
this is a great story. Jackie was in Maynard's band and played my high school in Roselle Park, New Jersey. I guess maybe when I was a junior or senior.
He was doing that even later on. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. My dad, sometime in the late 60s, mm-hmm. I think. Because he was on Maynard Ferguson on maybe 65. Mm-hmm. He wrote a lot of the charts too. But we went and like at intermission and got the second half of the concert, and Maynard introduced the band. And when he introduced Jackie, he stood up and said, ladies and gentlemen, I have an announcement to make. He goes, I've played all over the world on many pianos, and this is by far the worst piano I've ever played. And he said, it was bad that I had to transpose the book up a half a step.
Yes, and I could, and you didn't notice.
He did, and when I met him for the first time, I said, man, you were at my, he remembered the whole thing. He goes, oh, that piano, yeah, I remember that thing. It was just a piece of crap.
Oh, man.
But yeah, Tony was, that was my first big break. And George Russell was responsible for that happening, because George conducted the big band at NEC one semester. And we did this suite of music that George wrote called Living Time, which is incredible. It was a commission for Bill Evans Trio and a large ensemble. So it was released on CBS, incredible record. So this semester, George comes in. Usually Jackie took the band, but George had it this semester and brought in Living Time and said, you know, we're going to work on this stuff. And then at the end of the semester, he took a number of us aside and said, you guys are coming to New York with me. We're going to play it at Carnegie Hall. And Stanley Cowell was a, doing the Bill Evans chair, Stanley and his trio. So, and when I got there and set up, there was a very large yellow drum set.
Oh, you knew what that meant, yeah.
Yeah, because Tony was on the record, actually, Joe Henderson was on the record.
Yikes.
Tony, trying to think who else, Patty Bone, Snooki, probably. It's really amazing. Jimmy Giuffre was on the record. So
you were young. This is like you're 23, 24 at this point.
22.
Yeah.
And I was living on the Cape, and it was winter. I drove back down up to the Cape after the gig, and my roommate, you know, said, "Hey, man, Tony Williams just called. Here's his number." I was like, "Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly."
Yeah.
It's like, you mean the State Farm agent, Tony Williams, not the drummer? No,
the night manager from Cumberland Farms.
Yeah, it's a very common name. I mean, you know, it could get mixed up.
Yeah, and he just said, "Man, I'm putting a band together, and would you be willing to come down to New York and just play and see what happens?" And I just made an immediate turn, you know.
Yeah.
U-turn.
Yeah.
You know.
So wait. And, so was that? So when you first started it, was Holdsworth in the group at that point?
Yeah, when I got to Tony's brownstone, I walked in and Alan was there. So they had already formulated the thing. Then they were looking for the other bandmates. So I became number three, and then the three of us. Tony said, I heard about this bass player from Detroit, Tony Newton.
Sure.
You know, we should check him out. And then Tony flew in, and then the four of us started playing together. And, you know, next thing I know, we're in CBS Records making a record with Bruce Bach. in 2 days.
I mean, to me, just trying to put myself in your perspective, which is hard. I mean, at like a 25-year-old kid or whatever you were at that point, and with Alan Holdsworth in the beginning of his career and Tony just turning his career into something different after being with Miles for so long. And well, not no, no one was with Miles that long, but you know what I mean? And yeah. doing all these things, it's like, there must have been so much energy. It must have been such a wild, amazing yeah. experience. I mean,
it was incredible. Yeah, it was incredible. You know? And I'll tell you, I think I really believe that my time in Boston and my time spent with Stanton and Ghetto Mysticism, because the kind of music we were playing was really out, electric, right. You know, funk, some of it, but real conception, because Stanton was a student of George's and recorded with him on some of George's records. So, you know, it wasn't just, we weren't playing James Brown music. The stuff was out, right. but it was also really high energy. And it was music that allowed me to take a lot of chances, a lot of risks. So when we started playing, it kind of just felt like an outcropping of what I had been doing. It was like, oh yeah, let's right. do this. You know, it wasn't something that I had to really kind of shift gears and think like, oh, how can I make this work?
It was, right. It was in your wheelhouse.
You bet.
Yep. Yeah. And did you always play synth from the beginning of kind of when synth started coming out? Because I know you played Rhodes in the beginning, but I know with Lifetime yeah. and, you know, you've done plenty of it. So you always knew how to program and kind of, you know, get your way yeah. around?
The very first synth I got, I was, you know, these cool things, you know, that happened in Elite. I've been really fortunate. When I was living on the Cape, there was a guy that owned a club called the Velvet Hammer. Mm-hmm. And his name was Len Healy. I still remember him. Beautiful cat. And he hired me to play acoustic piano, just like, you know, background happy hour stuff.
Right.
And he had me do 3 shifts, like lunch, then a happy hour, and then a dinner set. And I was doing it like 5 nights a week. And I went to him. We were in his office one day. He goes, so, you know, what do you want to do, man? I said, well, you know, I want to save up enough money to buy this synthesizer. It was from a company in Connecticut called Electronic Music Labs. It was called the EML 1000, maybe. Right. I don't remember.
And it was monophonic or?
Monophonic, just sliders. And, you know, you got a sine wave, a square wave, and a sawtooth, and filters. You know, all the old synthesis. And he said, how much does it cost? And I said, $1,000.
Shit, that's a lot of money.
He went to his desk, man, took out his checkbook and wrote a check for $1,000 and handed it to me. He said, go buy this. And he goes, just work it off, you know.
Yeah.
Over some. That's badass.
Yeah.
Thank you, Len.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
That's like that career changing, those people that just help you along the way that you have to remember, you know, it's yeah. unbelievable.
That synth, we used it on the second Tony Williams record, Million Dollar Legs.
Man, so...
So I that's how I learned to play synth. You know, okay, let me figure this thing out. You know,
right.
and in the old days, the way it was all laid out, I mean, it's just a flow, you know, chart. Yeah.
I mean, if you can play organ, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, it's yeah. really just manipulating sound. And yeah. it actually made more sense back then than it does
totally.
Now. When you have a plug-in, it's like, with the presets, it's like... What the heck am I doing? But when you had the knobs yeah. and the sliders, you could just fuck with it until you got
when
it, right.
When it became algorithmic, that's when I just kind of, the heart and soul of synthesis yeah. went out of it for me.
You mean know? The DX7 or something like that?
Yeah. And on those synths, it was like playing a piano.
Yeah.
I mean, the keyboard was there, but the flowchart of all the synthesis is right in front of you. Mm-hmm. There's not layers of pages. It's like from left to right, man. You know, that's so I'm old school that way.
I have one of my good friends, Arna Wendt. He's a good friend from high school. He plays with John Bon Jovi and stuff now. But he's cool. He's just a classic synth player, and he has a real Prophet. He's got, you know, an old Moog. He doesn't have a modular, but you know who does.
Yeah.
You know, but he has a real Mellotron, I think. It's nice. Things like that. Just every, you know, his house is just filled with all these things, and they need love and care, but they're just so beautiful. And
they are.
And they make a hell of a lot of sense. it's like it actually is playing an instrument, because you know, just like playing you can get a lot of inflection just like playing a wind instrument or anything.
You know, the one keyboard I always lusted after that I never I could never find. Keith Jarrett played it when he was with Miles, when he was playing like two-handed,
right?
And it was a Fender organ.
Oh, I never heard. I never even seen that.
Damn.
And the key colors are reversed, and Keith would double his lines left and right.
Of course, he would.
Yeah, and
it's like a Baroque style organ for Fender.
Acoustic piano and that Fender organ sound together were so bad, man.
Yeah, man. Ooh. All right, so you're in on this like really historic group, and again, we talked about it. It must have been just so exciting, and seeing how this all went. Like, what inspiration did you get from this, and how did this kind of like help with the next part of your career? I mean, I know, for instance, just from listening to Holdsworth, I mean, he sounded a lot different. He morphed his sound like from. I mean, he still sounded like Alan Holdsworth, but you know what I mean. Like, he definitely evolved. Tony was always evolving. Like, how did this level of playing kind of help you out in your career? I mean, I'm sure in more ways than one.
Well, you know, the thread, because when the Lifetime ended, our last gig was at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium in Santa Monica, and when I moved to LA, I lived about a half a mile away from there.
Right,
and I would always drive by it and go, "Oh man,
that'd be cool."
What a drag. Bruce Botnick, a great legendary producer, produced The Doors and a lot of really historic rock records. Also, a great symphonic. Recording engineer. Was always on the cutting edge of. He was on the cutting edge of all the digital technology when Sony started introducing that. But Bruce was the only guy I knew when I moved to LA. So I called him up, and a few months later, I got a call from. He was a staff producer on CBS Epic Records label, and he said, "Man, I've got this. They've signed this new artist. His name is Eddie Money." And we need a keyboard player. And can you come over to my office in Century City tomorrow? And I was like, yeah, sure.
You're like, two tickets to paradise.
I'm playing on that.
Yeah, I know, man. It's great. Yeah.
Baby, Hold On to Me, all that stuff.
Man, those are great tunes.
I walk in, and there's Bruce, and there's Eddie. And before I even could say anything, Eddie says to me, "Hey Al, I don't want to hear any jazz shit."
Jeez, yeah, he had probably been talking about it for like an hour before you get there.
Bruce, I'm sure, was just pumping him full.
It's like he plays with Tony. Oh, that guy. No, I don't know.
I don't want to hear any jazz shit. And then he sits down. He goes, "Al, can you play this?" And like, you know, three knuckles. You know, please play on me. You know, his thing, the piano part to "Baby, Hold On to Me," and I'm like, "Wow, this is like the Rascals kind of white soul stuff." So. You know, I wound up doing the record, and then I went on the road with him for about maybe more than 3 months. It might have been a while. And while I was out on the road, I met at SIR, the Studio Instrument Rental Rehearsal place in New York, Rob Stoner, who was Bob Dylan's bass player.
Oh. And so wait, when was this? Is this before the 80s?
Eddie was 77.
Okay.
And then I got off of an Eddie tour like right before Christmas, and Rob and I had exchanged phone numbers. And I got this call from him. He said, "Hey, man, I'm in Santa Monica at Bob Dylan's rehearsal studio, and I'm putting together a touring band for next year. We don't have a keyboard player yet. Do you want to audition?" At first, I was like, "Nah, I don't know, man."
Right.
And then I called him back. I hung up and I called him back, and I went, "Absolutely, I do." So I went over, and he and I played, and he made some tapes, played them for Bob, and then I got invited to come in and audition. And there were like three of everybody, three drummers, three bass players. And as the week went down, it kind of got whittled down, and then I finally got the gig. So I went playing right from, you know, heavy fusion stuff right into the, you know, world of pop and rock.
Yeah, but it didn't sound like you had to, Well, it didn't sound like you were a fish out of water, is what I'm trying to say.
No, because in high school I played, you know, in right. rock band and loved it.
Right.
You know? Always loved it. You know. So it was just another part of what I, you know, the music that I loved and that I got to play.
Yeah, and that's a good gig. You know what I mean? Just in all respects. You know what I mean?
It was the best.
Yeah.
And he was spectacular. It was a great band too. It was a big band. It was after Rolling Thunder. So Jerry Sheff played bass from Elvis's band.
Oh, right.
Ian Wallace was the drummer. Mm-hmm. David Mansfield, Stephen Souls, Steve Douglas played saxophone. It was big, three background singers. Billy Cross played lead guitar. Bobby Hall and me.
Man, I mean, so, all right. So now we're getting closer to the 80s. When did you play with Brecker? Later.
I mean, I met Mike and Randy at Indiana University, which is where I went to college.
Totally.
My first 2 years.
Oh, just 2 years. Okay.
Yeah. And the second year, Peter Erskine and I were roommates. Mm-hmm. So that's how far back Pete and I go. Mm-hmm. In the mid 90s, I got contacted by a guy named Ralph Simon, who, when I was in high school, we used to do these Saturday afternoon jam sessions. And Ralph was one of the guys who played. I remember Chris Parker played. Some of the guys would come out from New York. And then, you know, time went by. And then he contacted me and said, man, you know, I'm affiliated with this small record label and I'm getting to produce artists. And, you know, I'm wondering if you'd be interested in want to make a record. And I was like, wow, you know, that was like my first record as a leader. That was on the Postcards label, and it was mm-hmm. a record called Milagro. And that was with Michael Brecker and Jack DeJohnette and Dave Holland.
Yeah, terrible band.
It was unbelievable, yeah.
Let me see. I was going through some of these credits, and some of them I didn't know about. I didn't know about Elton John, Aretha. You've had this
studio
stuff. Yeah. So you basically just ingrained yourself in the LA studio scene, right? And just started getting a lot of work in a lot of different genres. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of these weird guys. I didn't even know what the studio scene was. My first studio gig was, I got a call from Jack Nitzsche, the arranger and the composer, who did all the string, all the orchestrations for Tony Williams' second record that we did, Million Dollar Legs. There's strings on some of the, and brass on some of the tracks. And Jack liked me, and he was doing a movie called An Officer and a Gentleman.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
All of a sudden, I get a call. We have a double session on this date at 10 a.m. at Universal. So I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. Right. And I don't know the protocol, the etiquette. You know, I'm figuring it's like a jazz record date. You know, I walk in at like 10:03, you know, and I open the door and it's a 90-piece orchestra and the red light's on.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So the contractor just kind of ripped me a new one and basically explained in 10 seconds how it worked.
Right.
Yeah, and that was my foray into the LA studio scene. And then I started getting calls, you know, as a pianist and as a synthesist.
But you also eventually got into writing for films, right? Didn't you do The Waterboy and some other stuff?
I did. Yeah, I did a couple of, you know, something for HBO for Lenny Bruce.
Right.
And a B movie. And the director, Frank Caracci, who was a friend of Adam Sandler's, and said, you know, when it's my next turn to, you know, do something with Adam, I want to try and get you involved. And that came around, and it was The Waterboy.
Man.
So, yeah.
Let's talk about your students and kind of how you deal with them and giving them advice. Like, for instance, what would you say in a world like now, or what do you say to your students when they ask you the question, which everyone asks, like how to get gigs or how do I get started in my career? And like, what do you say? Do you have general advice or?
I mean, it's it's the same corny thing that probably everybody's heard a million times, but stay visible. Mm-hmm. Say yes to everything.
Yeah.
At first, because you can always say no later. And the thing I think that is the most important thing, and the thing that we musicians sometimes overlook because of how focused we are inwardly about what we do, is that the personal relationship is what really, really pays dividends over the long haul. It's the people you meet at college, the people you meet at gigs. You establish relationships with these people. These are the people you're going to be working with your whole life. As far as what's become of the music business that I grew up in and made a living in, I mean, it's so completely different now that I would be doing a disservice to anybody if I offered my advice.
Unlike TikTok or something like that.
Yeah, about how to monetize. But I do, I make sure that every one of my students that I work with is a member of ASCAP or BMI, and that they all take a pledge that they have to write music, and they think of themselves as a composer as well as an instrumentalist or a vocalist, but they have to write music.
That's actually really good advice.
It is, and it's how you really develop your voice as a player or a vocalist. It's not through shedding or even through playing a million gigs. It's through composition. That's how you really, really develop your sound, you know?
Also, it's important for people to understand that writing is one of those things that could just make you a ton of money randomly, it doesn't have to, but I know plenty of writers that just got a song and they were playing with an artist, and that artist decided to play their song, and then they bought a house.
I worked with a writing team, John Trivers and Liz Myers. We would write commercials, music for TV commercials. How did I meet these guys? It was because of a wrong number. John called my house and was asking for somebody else. And I was like, no, man, they don't live there. And he goes, man, you sound like you're from New York. I was like, nah, I'm from New Jersey. And we started talking and realized that we were in the same business. And then we got together to have a pizza or something. And all of a sudden, they became very busy writing music for a lot of ad agencies. And they would call me to help. And one day they said, hey, we got an invitation to pitch the theme for the CBS Evening News. They've never had music before. Mm-hmm. And will you please write a bridge for us? So they sent me a thing. Oh, I wrote the bridge. We wound up we were chosen. And so I had for 4 years a nightly news theme. Yeah. For royalties. I mean, for a wrong number.
Yeah.
And it went away. Yeah, it went away when Dan Rather retired, and then they hired Scott Pelley, and he said, I really like that old theme, and they brought it back for another 4 years.
Man.
So it's, you got to write. I mean, it's just, you have to write. You really have to think of yourself as a composer.
Yeah, and it's also one of those things where, I mean, I've written a lot of music for television, and I did that for years after just being a bass player, and I still get checks from things I did many years ago, and it's the kind of thing where, especially during a time like this, you start to realize how important that is, I mean, some people disregard it, and they're, it is what it is, but when it comes down to it, when the clubs are locked up, mailbox money is helpful.
Yeah, if you are a touring musician and you depend or you invested your entire life in live performance, which is awesome. I mean, it's my most favorite thing to do, but we now we now really can see how fragile it can be.
Yeah.
You can really, you know, and it's funny, teaching music had always kind of had a quiet, bad name. He's a teacher, you know.
Right.
You know, at which always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because I always had, you know, my music teachers were, they were masters.
Right.
You know, but it only takes one.
Right.
You know, to give it a bad name. And so it's, you know, when the world came crashing down, thank God, you know, that I could still have a platform to do something musical, you know,
mm-hmm.
besides practice.
And like you said, you have a lot of options because you've written music for film or TV and also compose your stuff and have a home studio. I mean, there's actually a plethora of stuff you can do. I mean, you could record, like you said, a solo album. You can even send tracks to someone that needs piano, or you can start writing or score things if you had that in your line, if someone asked you to do something. So, I mean, you do have a lot of, I don't know. I mean, you have a lot of possibilities because you set yourself up for that, which is good.
Yeah. And I mean, it didn't happen all at once, of course. You know, it happens over accumulation of years, and you know,
and after you became a Red Sox fan,
exactly. That's when
that was the good luck.
That's when the phone really started ringing. Let me tell you,
I don't like this podcast anymore.
Oh man,
wearing my Yankees hat right now. But
I always ask artists, like at your level, like confidence kind of stuff. Were there ever times where you were scared to take a gig where, I mean, this probably would have been like way in the beginning of your career, but that's a huge obstacle for a lot of people, is like when to cross into the next level, like professionally, not just in your bedroom, you know?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But like, did stuff like that ever really come up for you?
Oh, sure. It still does. I mean, you know, I pick and choose, you know, as I got older, I realized what my strengths are, you know, and when I was younger, I really couldn't necessarily see that so clearly, you know.
Yeah.
But let's see, you said one thing that kind of jarred a story. I told my students, I said, there's going to come a day when you are at a gig and you play your ass off and nobody in the band is going to say anything about it, and you're gonna go home and go, man, you know, did I suck? What was going on? and I said that's a really defining moment, because you have to know that you were good at what you did, and you just have to put that on your shoulders from that day forward, and never again. It's not like you need to be arrogant or, you know, be a braggart or anything like that, but you just need to carry that, like, that you do belong. Because, you know, when you're young, oh, beautiful, man, that sounded great. You know, and all of a sudden it's like you play your ass off and nobody says anything.
Yeah.
But that's also a testament to just like, they know.
Yeah.
Or they don't have to tell you anymore.
Or they were in their own head. Sometimes people on the bandstand are thinking about their own stuff, and they might not think they played well. So, you know, they're not in the, you know, I'm a bass player, so no one ever tells me that I was good. You know what I mean? You have to just believe that you're doing. You get called the next week, and then you know that, like, that you did well. Yeah. Like, oh, I got called again. I must have done well.
Yeah, but I mean, how many times, you know, have we, like, taken a gig and then, you know, we're like, oh man, I can't wait to play tonight, you know, and then you play and you think that it's really happening, and you come off the stage and people are like,
hey. Yeah, exactly.
And then other nights, you know, on the way to the gig, it's like, why did I take this stupid gig, man? And then you play and it's just, you're dark, you know, and it's just like, and you come off the stage and people are like, man, that's the best I ever heard you.
Right. You're like, let me hear that back. I don't know.
That is the depths of music right there.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's so fleeting. And you know what? Who cares? Right. Let it go, man. let it go.
What do you tell your students that might be either nervous or have some bit of stage fright or just don't feel like they can get off what they're doing in the practice room on the stage? Does that happen a lot with your students?
Yeah, I think probably what happens is they're more in their own head than in the moment. So they're missing those, you know, microsecond chances to make a musical contribution because they're
it's gymnastics.
Yeah, they're thinking about something else or oh, my reed sucks or how do I sound or whatever, you know. And it's like I just tell them, look, just when you go up, you know, hey, you have a responsibility when you're playing jazz. So, and it's not about that you get a good review or that people dig you. It's like you're carrying on a cultural tradition, period. That's responsibility number one. So that's a heavy responsibility. So you take that weight with you and just have an open slate. You know, it's the documentary on Love Supreme. I don't know if you guys ever heard it.
I haven't seen that.
It's a audio documentary that NPR did with Mos Def. He was the narrator. It's fantastic. Sure. And
check that out.
They interview Alice.
Yeah.
About that body of music about A Love Supreme. And she said, you know, John went up in the attic and, you know, a few hours later he came down and he said, you know, Alice, I have the whole body of work. And, you know, it was given to me. I received it.
I love it.
You know, and it's like, yes.
Yeah.
It's like,
that's the shit.
I just wrote A Love Supreme. Yeah. It was like, I just received this music. So it's like, if we can approach the bandstand like that, like, man, there's how many of us are up here? And I see it over and over again. I was playing a Grammy party with Pete Erskine and Garzon and Dave Carpenter, God bless him. And Chick walked in. Yeah. And I flipped. I was like, Chick, you know, please sit in.
Right.
And he sat in. And for the first, I just watched him. I just wanted to see what was going on. Like for the first three choruses, piano choruses, he's just like navigating, just looking around the stage, just kind of getting his bearings. And then, you know, bada boom. So it's.
Yeah.
Man.
What's the point of swimming if you don't know that you're in water, you know? It's like, look around for a little bit.
I mean, if your mind is...
I need to do that.
Yeah. If your mind is filled with, you know, your self-doubt or your to-do list or the fact that you didn't get this when you went shopping the other day or your parking ticket, I mean, you're definitely not going to be able to get to that place where you can really create, you know what I mean?
You know, a footnote to my Frank Foster story where he called Body and Soul in D. I was 22 and I got through the A section fine. But the whole A section, my 22-year-old brain was going, man, why did he call that tune in D?
Right.
That's some bullshit, right?
Totally sabotaging you. Yeah.
All of a sudden the bridge came. Yeah. And I went, oh my God. That's why he called it in D. You know, and if I was maybe 60 years old and that happened to me, I might be going, okay, think ahead. What's coming around the bend? Totally. You know, but
you'd know before the downbeat. Yeah. You'd know.
Yeah.
You'd be like, you know, this is the bridge. It goes up. It changes key. Yeah. It does this or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Music's hard though, because it's always at like even the worst level. It's always still rewarding and it feels nice.
Yeah.
Like I would always say compare it to like figure skating. If you're in your head and you're trying to do some tricks on ice skates and you don't trust something, you're going to fall.
You will fall.
You're trusting like physics. Yeah. So if you don't fully go into something like a turn, like you're just, it's going to be physically impossible for you to do it. So it's like, it's more obvious and stuff like that.
You can like music, die though.
You can get lost.
Yeah. You don't die as much.
But you know what I mean? Like, but that's what I'm saying is, so it, that's a harder thing to get around.
But you know,
like, you don't know that you're doing it.
There is an analogy to that though too. It's like if you're playing a tune and all of a sudden you say, I'm going to play something fast or, you know, technical stuff. It's over.
Yeah.
It's over. Because you already set yourself up to to get tense and to fail.
Yeah.
It's like that. I'm going to start on beat 2 and I'm going to carry it to that next message.
It's like, remember that Keith Jarrett solo I transcribed? There was that one lick. I'm going to try to.
Oh, man. Yeah. I just was talking to one of my students about that, about Jackie Bard. There's a line he plays in one of his blues. It's called Out Front. It's a great record. And he plays this line, and I told him, I confessed, I said, I am so not into licks. I don't believe in them. I said, but I had to transcribe this and play it. I just had to learn how to do it. And I said, no matter what I do, when I play it, it sounds like crap.
Yeah.
And when he plays it, it sounds like $1 million. Yeah. So I just don't do it anymore. I just put on the record if I want to listen to it.
It was meant for him, you know. It's his DNA.
Yeah.
You should need like the fingerprint lock to like play that lick, you know, on your iPhone. It's like, you know.
Yeah. I need the electric dog collar, you know. Yeah. Feels good.
Yeah. It's like watching someone try to play a Holdsworth solo or something.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of those on the internet, on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, you got to feel or even like Coltrane, you know, Coltrane has been emulated plenty, but
sure.
John Coltrane was feeling that and you could tell that it was not, I mean, it was just coming out of him, like you said, like he was given something from a higher power or whatever it was, you know. I mean, regardless, it's it feels like that when you listen to
you know, whether it was even something that he was searching and figured out or if it just, you know, came to him naturally, who knows.
So what are you looking forward to doing? You know, we're getting late on in this podcast and we're going to just a few more minutes, but what are you looking forward to doing? Like once there's normalcy in the world, are you looking to kind of tour or are you pretty stable where you are?
No, I mean, I think I've got to get out there and do some live music.
Yeah. Or else you're going to go insane.
I am. I'm actually going to Boston in, first week of December.
Okay.
To play with John Patitucci and Adam Cruz and Marco Pignataro. It was going to be a live stream for WGBH, but now we're actually going to videotape it. We're doing all this old Neapolitan music, folk songs.
Oh, man.
Killer stuff. And John, with a string quartet from the BSO. Mm-hmm. John did all the arrangements.
He's great.
And that'll be the first live music I've done since March with Garzón. And then, you know, I think hopefully once New Year's goes by and we get the vaccine and people start getting healthy and
chill out.
Then, you know, hopefully maybe Europe next summer, next fall, something like that.
Right.
You know?
It'll come back slow, but it'll hit the small venues, I think, will be okay.
Yeah, it's going to come back. The worst, or I don't know about, I hope the, you know, the people aren't suffering too much more. But I in terms of the length of this whole thing, I think the worst of that's past us.
I hope
we got to get through the. We got to get through the holidays. I know it's going to be tough, but yeah, I want to. If I just teach, I'll go out of my mind.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
I have to play. You know.
Yeah,
and I have to play with other musicians that I love. You know.
That's
the bottom.
I mean, it's an equilibrium, and that's why like a teacher like you is so important. It's not because you're teaching so much; it's because you have all this other experience that you're continuously involved in. Mm-hmm. So it's like, the students need that. They need someone that's out there doing it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that excitement from you coming back to them, like that's important.
And, you know, USC has been great that way. They've always wanted me to go out and, you know,
Of course.
And play and, right. you know. So it's been a.
I mean, that's the whole idea behind My Music Masterclass. It's not just like people teaching stuff. It's people that are doing stuff and teaching stuff at the same time.
And also, it's funny, man. It's like I preach all the time to people about, you know, making friends and like the stuff you said. You know, you have to. Music and your career is built on relationships. And if people don't want to be around you, you don't get hired, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
But when it comes down to it, if you think it over, it's like the act of making music is exactly the same thing. You know what I mean? You're supposed to be compatible on stage, like having conversations and doing all these things and being friends regardless. I mean, of course, you've heard of all these bands that are to hate each other and, you know what I mean? Not a lot, but this, you know, it's like... Like, you know, like the Sting and Stuart Copeland having fights or something like that, or, you know, but most of the time it's like, if you're in a group, you guys are a family, you know, I mean, so it shouldn't have to be that difficult, you know, at the same time, it is hard for people to realize that it's that deep because some people don't have the same social skills and they have to work on that, you know, they have to go hang and not just because they think it's going to get them a better career. They need to make friends, you know?
Yeah, and if you hang because you think it's going to get you a better career, that's written all over your, you know, your coat.
Yeah,
and people are smart. You know, if you're not genuine, you know,
they don't want people that are just there to take.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you're not there for the hang, then don't hang.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Just go play Xbox or something.
Yeah.
But man. Dude, thanks so much for coming on with us, Alan. It was great hanging and you know, virtually hanging. This is nice. This is like my vacation too. This podcast, you know.
This is such a great idea, man. And I feel so much better now than I did an hour ago.
Wow. Wait. All right. There's something there.
Yeah.
I feel good, except I'm staring at those Fenway seats, and you know, I have a slight anxiety.
Oh, right,
no. I'm good.
I can't see past that piano. That's all I can see, man.
You see,
I'll send you a picture of me holding my daughter Greta when she was 3, and both of us have Yankee hats on.
All right. I'm okay. I'm good.
And then I'll also send you the picture of me and her at Fenway.
With the big green monster in the back.
I'm good.
All right, man. Thanks so much. And we'll talk soon. And, you know, and maybe we'll do some more stuff soon. It'd be great.
Yeah, love to. Always. Great all to see you both and hear you both.
Have a good trip.
Yeah, man. Happy holidays.
Be safe.
Thanks. Yeah, happy holidays. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Stay safe and healthy.
Right on.
Bye.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformancepathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So look forward to hearing from you.